This is Regenerative Skills, the podcast helping you to learn the skills and solutions to create an abundant and connected future. I'm your host, Oliver Gaucher.
Through their diverse range of publications, New Society Publishers books explore topics that are at the forefront of creating positive change in our world. From regenerative agriculture and permaculture to social justice and eco-conscious living, their books cover a wide spectrum of subjects that empower readers to lead more regenerative and fulfilling lives. Now, whether you're a seasoned environmentalist, a curious beginner, or someone simply seeking inspiration and guidance on your journey towards regenerative living, New Society Publishers is here to support you every step of the way. Now exclusively for listeners of this podcast, you can use the code SKILLS25 and receive a 25% discount on all ebooks at newsociety.com. That's all one word and lowercase, SKILLS25 on all ebooks. So level up your knowledge today at newsociety.com. Hey there, everybody, and welcome back. So in the process of researching the area that I now call home and working to understand the context and the history of the land, I've uncovered some fascinating information. So the Iberian Peninsula, made up mostly of Spain with Portugal along the Atlantic coast and Andorra in the Pyrenees Mountains, has been dramatically transformed through thousands of years of human history, to say nothing of prehistoric and geological times. There are caves and monuments here that point to some of the earliest evidence of human habitation in Europe. Empires from the Romans through the Visigoths and the Umayyad Caliphate, as well as various ruling families of the peninsula, have all left their mark on the culture and, of course, the land. The Spanish Empire fueled the colonization of the Americas and the immense sequestration of resources and wealth that followed. This involved unprecedented exchange of biological resources, too, that have even become associated with the local cuisine, with ingredients like tomatoes and potatoes, which are, of course, originally from South America. The Civil War in the 1930s eradicated many rural villages and oppressed non-Castilian cultures and resulted in a government structure that still only loosely holds together 17 autonomous communities. Modern industrial agriculture continues to shape the land like never before, and it's all just a superficial explanation of what adds up to the landscape and the context that I now find myself building a life in. So you can see why I've been on a mission since I arrived to find others to help me to better understand the complexities and the nuances of the never-ending journey of finding my place in this place. This episode is my first attempt at bringing you along with me in this research effort, and we have the pleasure to speak to a friend of mine who has built an incredible understanding of the Spanish context through the lens of biology and regenerative landscape design. Sara Garcia is the founder of Ecoloniza and lead designer at United Designers International. As a forest engineer and permaculture designer, she concentrates on creating ecological design solutions that integrate hydrological cycle management systems, techniques to enhance soil health, and the restoration of native plant communities and ecosystems. Through her experience, she's learned that project success depends not only on a well-thought-out design, but also on effective management, keen observation, and the ability to adapt. As a result, Sara emphasizes the importance of embracing a role as stewards of the land and actively monitoring the progress of the implemented design. Now, I reached out to Sara originally to help me map out and to understand the geology and the biome of the unique little pocket of the pre-littoral mountains of Catalonia where I live, but I quickly realized that I had so much more to learn from her knowledge and experience. In this episode, Sara and I will talk in more detail about the history and the influences that have shaped the land and life across the Iberian Peninsula, both the good and the catastrophic, as well as the trajectory that we find it on in modern times. From there, we talk about what is needed to set a new course for ecological prosperity for our region before going into the key awareness and understanding that is required to act appropriately in any of the immensely different bioregions on the peninsula. With that information as a base, we also go into the actions and areas of focus that anyone can take to contribute to the regeneration of our incredibly special corner of the earth. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, where I live is nothing like Spain. Maybe it won't be interesting or useful for me. And my reply to that would be that episodes like this, where I take you along my own journey of research and discovery and attempt to become an integrated steward of my land and community, is meant to act like a case study of the steps that anyone can take to learn more about their own place on this planet and how to actively participate in setting a new trajectory for abundant and resilient life for that space. This is one of many episodes that I have planned to give you all a window into what will be a lifelong pursuit of what could be described as my personal efforts to become a person of place or to re-indigenize myself. There are endless ways to approach this vision and so many perspectives to explore. So I'm excited to get this series started with this first conversation with Sara Garcia. So welcome, Sara, and it's wonderful to have you here on the podcast today. How are you doing?
Thank you. Very good. You?
Can't complain. I mean, it's still very dry here in Catalonia, but it's a beautiful day. The temperatures have finally started to go down a little bit. It's been unusually warm for February. And I've got some deliveries of materials that are going to get a couple of my projects started out this year. So I'm getting excited. What about you? What's new from your side?
Well, not much. Still working on my projects and with United Designers. And actually, just doing that, just the projects, not much. Waiting for the rain also here. I'm in Madrid and I'm also waiting for the rain and the temperature drop, so we can have a little snow in the mountains for it to melt and fill the rivers.
Yeah, all the mountains I've been able to observe from around here have had very little snow, and that is also worrying for the coming months. But let's not dwell on that too much. We'll come back around. Before we talk more about the projects that you just mentioned, why don't you give me a bit of your personal background and how you started to work in regenerative design?
Well, actually, I am a forest engineer, and at the beginning of my career, I worked as a forest engineer, but certain things happened in my life and, you know, life goes through, and I changed my path career, and I started working different things in environment, so related to environmental things like management of residues, of waste, and different kinds of things. But then my true vocation came back, and I discovered, meanwhile, permaculture, which was a big change in my life. And then I decided I wanted to go back to where I started, which is working with environments and trying to make like solutions that will balance human and, you know, and nature in this is where I am trying to do that.
So this is really interesting because I have some good contacts and friends around here who are forestry technicians, and I don't really understand or have a background in what it is that they are taught that informs them to how do they do their job. And seeing as that's how you started out, can you give me a window into the curriculum, into what forestry engineers are taught in Spain? Because to me, that would give me an understanding of what informs them in the way that they manage the forests around me.
Well, this is, I mean, I studied many years ago. I don't really know how it is right now. But when I was in college, what they taught us is we have like two different ways to go. One, that it was more conservation of the soil, of the mountains, of the forests, the animals that live there, and these kinds of things. And the other was more orientated towards the business, you know, the business of the wood, of the paper, of even like the hunting is a business, and trying to keep a balance between those. That was more or less what we were taught. And one important thing that maybe I should tell is that here we have like forestry engineers and agronomic engineers, and many people ask me what's the difference between one and the other. And one of the basic differences that I tell is very simple, is that they use irrigation and we don't.
Okay.
So it seems like very simple, but when we do reforestation, we never, a forest engineer never counts on irrigation for that future forest to grow and thrive. But when you are talking with an agronomist, sometimes they do use irrigation, like for certain crops. And we do, as forest engineers, never use fertilizers and, you know, all those stuff that are common in agriculture. Those are, it's the different point of view to do things.
Right.
And honest.
Yeah, the timber industry is, of course, much more oriented towards production. And the agronomist's view is how to produce lumber or, you know, other forestry products. So it makes sense that they use kind of a broader a range of tools in order for that production orientation. That's really interesting. So building on that within your studies, and then, like you said, the changing moment for you when you took permaculture design courses, how has all of these different types of education, training, information informed what you do as a designer now?
Well, for me, I feel very lucky that I have my previous college studies, because they are a very good complement to the permaculture way of thinking and methodology and to the ecology. I mean, it is ecological restoration, but the forest engineers do. So it's a perfect pack that goes together. But the permaculture way gives me more of a holistic view of things that maybe I wasn't taught before, or at least I didn't feel like. So now I got this total view of things. That's what I think.
And that's, yeah, I think, and that's really necessary to be effective in the type of work that requires a more holistic view of things. So give me an example of some of the projects that you work on, both in your own company and with United Designers.
Well, for my own company, I usually do smaller projects that are between, it could be urban edible gardens of like around 1,000 square meters, or fincas or of around 2 or 3 hectares, even 7 I have done. And basically, this is 2 different ways of designing. If you're in urban or if you're in rural, it's very different. But in the rural areas, it's always a part of, they want some kind of agriculture productivity so they can earn some living or some money. But they want it mixed with some ecological restoration. And of course, always, since we are in Spain, some kind of design to integrate, to manage the water, you know, the water cycle within the finca. And in the urban areas, it's more, the design is more of designing an edible garden that it's a beautiful garden that they can live in, but also that it produces, not only produces food, but I try to close the cycles of materials inside. So they create their own compost, they reuse the water in different parts of the garden. So trying to close the things within. So it is 2 different, one bigger and smaller scale, really is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I do with the Coloniza. And with United Designers, it's more or less the same thing, but even a bigger scale, because the works I have participated in United Designers are basically the same thing. They want some agriculture or agroforestry systems, a lot of ecological restoration and increasing biodiversity, restoring the soil and designing wider water retaining elements or so, but in much bigger surfaces.
Nice. Yeah, and I've worked quite a bit on both of those scales too. I'm curious, from your perspective, what are the major differences in considerations, knowing that most of the ecological patterns are the same? What are the differences in your approach for those two scales?
Well, one major difference that I see is that even though gardens are less surface, they require more attention to detail, to the little things, because of the smaller surface. So, and many people that live at that want those gardens are people that live in the city, are really disconnected with the nature. So they have to start the learning process from the beginning, from zero. So, and that it's something that I always, when I finish a project, I don't just give them the project. I usually have like a little tutorial with them to go through the process to see, so they understand when I say building the soil, so they understand what does that mean. When we talk about different uses of water, they understand how the water flows, why it's important, this and the other. So we have to start from the beginning. And in bigger scales, yeah, there are usually people more used to the countryside, and they already know a lot of things. and they already are much in contact with nature and have done some observation and have experiences that help them learn much better, understand really faster some processes.
I really like that reflection. I think I found that to be very true in my experience as well. Now, beyond the work that you do as a designer, part of the interest that I had in connecting with you for this episode is that you have a really unique understanding of the biology here in the Iberian Peninsula. Your plant databases that you've helped to contribute to and the reports that you've done that I've seen through United Designers have really caught my attention. And you and I have already had conversations on the back that have been really helpful for me in understanding the plant communities in my biome. And though we'll get more into detail about the different biomes as we see them currently, let's start with what you can tell us about some of the biological history of the peninsula, because this place used to be very different from how people experience and see it now.
Yeah. It's been said that a squirrel could go from north to south in Spain, going from one branch to the other. That's what's supposed to be said. I think it's very important to understand the history of the landscape and what has happened and what we have done as part of the nature. Spain has different, very different landscapes and different climates. And you cannot talk of it as a whole, but because it has its own things. But there has been certain things in history that has changed the landscape a lot. Like for example, prior to the Romans, Spain there were living some tribes that they lived on the Celtas, the Celtics. They lived here. And they have a certain way of understanding their life in within the nature, and they have respect for the trees. And what is most important, even though they have agriculture, they live a lot from the acorns, which we have plenty in the Iberian Peninsula, as you know. But when the Romans came and invaded Spain, and it became part of the Roman Empire. So they needed, they needed to feed their soldiers that were fed with wheat. So they started cutting a lot of surface of forest in order to plant wheat to feed their armies. And in the other side, if they make the people that already live in the Iberian Peninsula that were in tree because they harvested the food from the trees that were surrounding them. If you cut those trees and you make them think that they only live through wheat, it's also a way to control the population for the Romans. So that was a big change in the landscape when they came and things started to change. And then, I don't know, many things have happened through the history in Spain. Like, for example, I don't know if you know, I do not know the name in English. So, La Mesta, you know what La Mesta is?
I haven't heard this one, no.
Okay, in the Catholic kings in Spain, you know who the Catholic kings, they realized that there was a really big business in selling wool from a breed of sheep that live here in the Iberian Peninsula. So they promoted a lot this, and they created what is called Las Cañadas Reales, which is paths that go from north to the south of Spain, so the shepherds could move their sheep from the north in the summer to the south in the winter. And it was a really huge, huge business by those times in the medieval ages in Spain that moved a lot of money. So the kings on those times promoted and make a lot of laws to help them. And doing that, those big movements of cattle through the Iberian Peninsula, they needed a forage. So they cut many, many, many hectares of trees. So they have forage fields for those while they were moving from north to south twice a year. And that really also changed a lot the landscape and took away many of the course, that's in the medieval ages. And then I don't know.
That's really interesting.
What else can I think that?
Yeah, I didn't know about
unless
that
we
one.
All know.
That's like medieval versions of transhumanism, right? Where wool became enough of an industry that there was actually policies and new routes that were cut into the landscape that fueled deforestation in order to get more forage along these routes that facilitated basically the commodification of this thing that they wanted to promote, right? I did know a little bit about the Roman impact through the work of Dr. Milan in the Valencia region, about how, especially along the Mediterranean coast, much of that used to be wetland, followed by very old growth oak forests uphill from those. One of the things that was really interesting for me when I started looking into the history of this area is I didn't realize that the Celtic cultures and people actually came from the Iberian Peninsula originally. I usually had always associated them with the British Isles, the UK in general, which, you know, we often kind of think of as, you know, Irish or even Scottish culture. But these were people who actually came from the north of Spain originally. That was fascinating for me. And like you said, a staple diet based around acorns and tree crops would, of course, have a very, very different ecological impact from a culture that was dependent on those than the subjugation of those people that was fueled by a switch over to wheat and annual crops. And, you know, it's political, it's industrial. The many, many changes of occupiers from the Romans to the Moors to the Visigoths to the, you know, all of the ones that have passed through here have all left their mark on the ecology and started to bring us to the case that we find now. Can you add to some of the things that I've very quickly skipped over?
Yeah, that's more or less, I mean, through the last, I can say 100, 150 years, Spain has been, not Spain, the Iberian Peninsula has been deforested a little bit more and more and more. And then what everything accelerated to the top since the 70s, I think, because of two things. First, the Green Revolution came with the big tractors. Mm-hmm. And like in the center of Spain, that really were a little towns living of wheat but there was a little trees and some, you know, there were still some forest because before the tractors, people were not able to cultivate so many, so big surfaces. But then the tractors came in the 60s, late 50s, 60s. And as they grew bigger, this is a story I've seen in my home, I mean, where the town where my family is from. Since the tractors grew bigger, the surfaces they were cultivating with wheat grew bigger and bigger. So they cut out more trees and more trees. It came to a moment that they even plow over springs and over by the edge of the river, which you were destroying the riparian.
Yeah, the riparian corridor, community. Sure.
So you were destroying the water cycle, the small water cycle, because they could with those big machines and they wanted to make money. And those were good because they have never been plowed before. Those were really healthy and good lands to cultivate. And now you see Castilla, you know, the center of Spain, and you see almost no trees. Everything is yellow. Affected since the 70s. That, and in the coast, the urbanism, you know, and as the tourists came and we began building and building and building and cutting. And as you said, taking out the marsh and cutting the forest. And now everything, and there's no, I mean, everything is urbanized. Not everything, but almost.
Yeah, yeah.
And that really affected, as you said, Millán has proved that how that affects the climate, the formation of the summer storms, and that there's already scientific proof of that.
Yeah,
and that got us where we are.
Well, maybe we can summarize that because it's such an important example to shine a light on. And it's been going on here for such a long time, but because it's been so accelerated with the tourism industry along the Mediterranean coast, we're starting to feel the effects of it in a way that has been accelerated recently. So like we talked about before, so most of the Mediterranean coast was very much marshland. And I believe the Romans had a lot of experience draining swamps along coastlines because they did it in and around Rome in the Tuscany area, which I got to see firsthand from farmers that I visited in that region. I didn't realize there was like very similar patterns even closer to home for the Romans. And then, of course, the deforestation that came along from there. And what typically happens in the summer is you get higher temperatures in the Mediterranean, which of course forces a lot of evaporation and humidity into the air, which when it comes into land, if it receives the extra little percentage of moisture that it needs from wetlands, from dispersion from trees, and of course the little bacteria and fungi that are expelled from the respiration of trees, it can then fall as consistent rain. And like you said, this has been well documented from a long time before that you would get consistent thunderstorms in the afternoon in the summertime, which would take the edge off of the heat and continue to water plants without the need for external irrigation. Now, of course, as all of those swamps have been drained, as more and more of the coastline has been built up, there is no opportunity. In fact, you get higher heat and pressure systems that come off of the coast, which push that moisture higher and carry it further inland, which can arguably be directly traced to the massive flooding that's happening in Central Europe these days. So we get another rain, it turns into massive flooding in the center, and it's not good for anybody. Is that a good summary as far as you understand it?
Yes, it's actually it is. It is. That's how Mian described it. He's the expert of this. So in my conclusion, and I mean, it's a positive and a negative thing. It's positive that we have persons like Mian has brought opened our eyes to see that really what we do with the uses we do with the landscape can change the climate, can change the circumstances. And that's a positive thing. And the negative thing is that so far we have done not things not so good, but it's in our hands to change it because we know the reason that some of the reasons why we are where we are. There are many others, of course, huh? But this is a big one, and it's in our hands to change it and to do
Absolutely.
something about it.
Now, before we go into some of the more modern opportunities that we have and the different techniques that are available to people, I'd also like to make sure that we go over some of the historical, let's say, transplants of technology and of ways of managing land that have not all been detrimental, right? It hasn't just been one uninterrupted slaughter of the ecosystem here. There have been some interesting contributions. I'm particularly thinking of one example from the Moorish occupation of about 700 years and the irrigation technology that they brought from places like Iran and North Africa and the Middle East. And that has had a major impact on not only the capacity for, let's say, annual agriculture and some poorer practices that came along with it, but allowed the distribution of even irrigation and gravity-fed irrigation, especially in the Al-Andalus area and all the way up the Mediterranean coast. Can you give a description of at least some of your understandings of those? Because I've only seen a couple of examples.
Of there's more there are a few examples that are amazing of how people have done things apart from the irrigation systems without any electricity and everything that were amazing and they could not only irrigate but give water to a whole city that they were amazing, but they are also in Sierra Nevada. There are a I cannot recall a name right now. They made a system. I don't know if you've seen it. That they made like trenches through the mountains to hold the water and to create artificially create because they were holding the water and the water was infiltrating inside the mountain and they will create springs. Also, trees of how to do compost from the Muslim area where they were in Italy or Granada. There are a lot of agriculture. Treatment, no, tratados.
Treatments, sure.
Where they explain how to use the organic material, how to compost, when to compost, everything that is now like regenerative. They were many of those things. They were already doing them, and they exported it everywhere in the Iberian Peninsula. I don't know. Now that I can think of, and in
So
more modern, yeah.
the canals up in the Sierra, is that similar to like the Levada systems in Portugal and the islands of Madeira and Tenerife?
I do not know. I do not know.
Oh, that'd be interesting to check. I guess we both have a little more research to do.
Oh,
Because
yes,
those are the
I
ones that
just.
I have referenced as the description that you're giving. I was fortunate enough to hike some of the Levadas in Madeira, and my good friend Nick talks about them in Tenerife. So I'd imagine that sounds like a similar system.
I cannot remember. I have to check it out. I cannot remember their name right now. But those are amazing. And the most amazing thing is that nowadays they're still working.
Yeah,
No, like
exactly.
so many time after they build them, they are still working and they are still doing the same. And they were built through observation of seeing how the water, it's amazing. It's really amazing. And I don't know, more recent things that have the humans have done that, in my opinion, are really interesting is like in the 19th century in El Golfo de Rosas in Catalonia in a village that it's San Martín de Ampurdán. Well, never mind. Over there, the long in the Middle Ages, there were two rivers that went to that beach. But in the Middle Ages, they decided to channel those rivers and change them, and because of that, the sand that was bringing in by the waves from the sea was accumulating in the beach, creating a dune, a coastal dune, that because of the tramontana, the windows, it eventually became an internal dune. Really huge, but like I've been there. I went with the college actually with my botanical professor. It was amazing. It was really huge. It came to a moment, and it does that. It started building from fifth. It built itself from to. It took 5 centuries to build, adding because of the change of the challenging of the rivers. It came to at the end of the 19th century, it became that this dune was invading the town because it was growing over it. So it was a real problem. And they came in at the end of the 19th century and said, we have to do something to restore this, to help this. I mean, this cannot be built. So they could not unchannel the rivers. But they started with ecological succession, first planting herbaceous and then bushes, and they stabilized the whole dune that is like, I don't remember, let me check. It's really huge. It's like, I don't know, I don't remember the surface right now, but they stabilized the whole dune, and now it's a huge forest. And now nowadays, like a century and after, and you see the forest and you could think it's a natural forest and it's always been there. No, it was a dune that it was
Engineered.
invading the town, and they did it, and they did it, working with nature. And this was 150 years ago, so when people were already doing things back then. And that is some of the examples of things we can do. Not only is not a dune anymore, it's not a hazard, it's a forest that works with the what we just talked with the summer storms, and because it's in the coastal line. And this is really great in my opinion.
Oh man, I've got to go see that. I had not heard about this. I'm only about an hour away from Rosas in the cove that you're talking about. And a good friend of mine has a farm in that region. So I got to make a trip to go and look at that now. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's very amazing. I don't know if you can visit it. By the time I went to visit, I went with the school, with my school, the forest engineers, and we have a special permission to walk because it's really delicate. If you walk, the
Oh,
soil
sure.
is really delicate and it can break up very easily. Actually, the interior dune is really stabilized, but the coastal one is now having problems because many people go to the beach and they walk through the dunes, the coastal, and they
That's
are
hard,
like
sure.
breaking it up. So it's I don't know if you can get in. You have to ask.
All right, I'll plan that. I'll see if I can pull some strings and make some contacts. So, okay, so beyond the examples that we have from history of things that have gone well, I do actually want to go back to how the watershed has been impacted more intentionally. So it's harder to observe the results and the changes of, let's say, rainfall after you've drained swamps or you've started to cut down trees on the coastline. But there have been also some very big engineering projects, and I'm thinking specifically of the Franco years, where they started to do big hydrological dams and change the flows of rivers for, it was about 30, 40 year period there.
Yeah, well, I don't think, and this is a personal opinion, I don't think the dams, the embalses they made on those times really affected the hydrological cycle of the big rivers, because they're just retaining, and then, I mean, it's not cutting out the water. It's just retaining to use some of it, but the river is still flowing. Maybe, or almost for sure, it's flowing with less caudal, with less
like sediment and water. Nutrient.
No, an amount of water, maybe it's not as big as it might have been in other times.
Oh yeah,
but
sure.
I don't think that is really a problem. This is my personal opinion. I think the problems, because I mean the captation surface around the embalses is an area that is really protected, is fully covered with forest, is very well taken care of, the surface around it, the captation, the superficie captación,
the surface of the capture.
Yeah, and that part is really being taken care of. I think it's what has harmed more the hydrological cycle, and this is what I've seen. It's more what I told you before, is that the forests have been cut in order to produce more easy and fast money, you know, like wheat or sunflowers, or at least in central Spain. And there has been like no respect for springs, for little seasonal rivers, little marshes. Those all have been like gone through the tractor and get it. Those are the little water cycle impact. That is where it has been really hurt.
Interesting.
At least what I have seen.
Yeah, and I think there is kind of a case-by-case basis. I've heard a lot of people talk around my area, which drains into the Pantano de Sau, the really famous hydroelectric project that was done back in the 60s that actually sunk an entire town. And it's the one that they always put images of when there's a drought in the region, because there was a church that was sunk in that town, and you can tell the level of the reservoir based on how much of the church steeple is sticking up. I'll post some pictures in the show notes for this, but there are a lot of people around here who have talked about how this area, and especially the Las Guillerías Natural Park that we border, used to be so much richer in water. And as part of the effort of putting in that hydroelectric project, they drained a lot of the natural features around here in order to fill that dam even more quickly. And now that the dam is entirely dry, there is nothing left up further in the mountains that would retain moisture. And, you know, we're in the dire situation that we are. But it might be a case-by-case basis thing. And, you know, both you and I are always in this learning journey of trying to figure out exactly what the biological, geographical, and land management history are for the specific areas of the peninsula when we do projects or when we do research. So this is always interesting to explore. But I love getting the context and the knowledge that you've built from this more overview that you have of this area and having worked here much longer.
I guess, yes, it's case by case. And as I told you, I mean, Spain is every country has very different landscapes and conditions in different places. And we cannot generalize.
It's true. This is a very biodiverse region. There's so many microclimates. There's so many differences and variables when you go to different areas of the peninsula. But I'm also curious, because you know, been part of these discussions and have been aware of the way that politicians and land managers have talked about the urgent need to do something about the trajectory that the ecological situation of this region is on. Where do you see hope in how the authorities, the government are seeing the urgency of this problem? And where do you see that the narrative is really actually destructive?
Well, I am a little skeptic with the politicians in general. So where I see hope is in the people. I think 52% of the surface in Spain, of Montes, you know, that it's not agricultural, it's forested.
Yeah.
It belongs to private owners, 52% of it, which is a huge amount of surfaces. If private owners start doing things differently and it start to find a way to balance economic and ecosystem, they will be the example for the authorities to change the law. That's my opinion. Like if private owners of fincas will start doing things that are already starting and are creating great examples to see this new balance, then the politicians will change. But that's my opinion, not the other way around.
Sure, I could definitely see that. It's interesting to see that there's pressure and incentives brought about by the larger European government, the European Union, that is starting to trickle down to more local areas. But I think both you and I have seen firsthand how the regulations and the bureaucracy around land management can often really hold back regenerative work. And well-intentioned landowners face a lot of red tape and a lot of hurdles to jump through, even if they're trying to do something positive. Have you seen any hope that this could get easier for people trying to do the right thing?
I think that eventually, as more people start doing things, the people that are given the permits will start like opening their minds and accepting certain things that nowadays many of them are not approving. And like, I don't know, I don't really know, because I don't know how much they are tied to their own regulations in order to give the permits, and the regulations depends on the legislation. You know, it's a really slow process.
It is.
But as I said, for me, the only way to change things is by example and seeing how my neighbor is doing this, and he made a pond and now his spring is back. And that will make people reflect, oh my God, so maybe we have to do things differently. And then the local government will see it and will allow it, which nowadays they are not allowing in some places. And I don't really see other way to do it, really.
Sure. I completely agree. You really do have to lead by example, even if it's difficult, and even if, you know, the journey to get there is not very linear. I'm curious to know, from your experience and from the projects that you've done, where have you started to see, let's say, the actions or the design elements that have really resulted in transformation and restoration from the projects that you've worked on or seen around you?
Well, there's a project that I have not designed, but it's really amazing. This project has been done by an association of neighbors of a little town, and they are trying to recover their old marsh and their old springs, all paid and worked by them. It's by the community, and this started some years ago, but the direct result on this is that this little town belongs to a coto de caza, you know, and the hunters came only for the birds because they didn't have a caza mayor, big animals there, because it was really dry and no
any large game.
They didn't have deers or boars or anything. And since this project started, these animals have come back in the lapse of less than 5 years.
Oh, wow.
So this is really amazing, really. And this is something that people have done by themselves because they've lived there. Their families are from there. They know from their grandparents that it used to be a spring there. It used to be, you know, from, you know, oral tradition, they have told and they have collected all this information, and they are trying to work on that. And I think it's unbelievable. I think it's great, so great.
That is such a beautiful story. What region of Spain is that in?
This is in Segovia. It's a little town in Segovia that is called Bellocillo.
Okay. Well, maybe if you can find a link or some other information on it, I would love to see it, and I'll put it in the notes as well.
So I'll give you the link. I am part of the association.
Oh, wow.
Of this association.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so, I mean, first of all, almost all of my most inspiring examples that I can think of are also community-led and are done by usually a group of people. It's very rarely just a single landowner, right? This is really where things can pick up steam and start to affect an entire region. And it's also very much the ethics by which United Designers works in bringing in as many perspectives and as many viewpoints onto a project as possible. This power of, you know, the community, the group is really what I think makes them stand out among other design areas. So, you know, aside from individual projects, I am really interested in your ideas about what it would take collectively for us living here on the Iberian Peninsula. This is Spain, this is Honduras, this is Portugal included, to start to put us on a different ecological, biological trajectory away from the degradative cycles that we currently find ourselves in. What do you think the actions or the policies or the you know, what's it going to take?
I mean, I don't have the golden answer, but in my opinion, as you know, rural Spain is almost nobody lives there. It's what is called the empty Spain, no?
Yeah.
And the empty Spain it's empty because of many reasons, because the lack of money, resources, services for the community, but many reasons. But one of the reasons, the big reasons, is the degradation of the environment. If we start applying regenerative agriculture at the same time with restoring the ecosystems are surrounding these agricultural lands, and they start working on the defragmentation of the land, working on restoring little water cycles and change things, those lands will be productive enough, will give enough money for people to live in right conditions. So maybe some young people will come back and start living again and taking care. If you live in a place, you take care of that place because it's your home, like the forest by your house or the fountain that it's at the end of the at the bottom of the town. No?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If people come back, they will take care of that. And right now there are so many tools like regenerative agriculture and all this, the techniques and strategies and everything that it's already on the plate that is there to just get it and put it on use, that will change things and will change tremendously the environment and will change tremendously at the circumstances we are in right now, I think.
Yeah.
Because right now we only have, like at least in the center of Spain, which is the place where I know more, big, huge fields of wheat with big tractors, or more in the south of you have olive trees or vines, but they are all plowed once and then again, no trees, no biodiversity, no continuity for the animals to move for the seeds of the little woods that are the forest to have a genetic mixture. Or no, they are like islands. The forests that are right now, they're islands. They are losing their genetic,
their ability to reproduce.
No, they, it's like
their this is genetic diversity.
Yeah, they have the genetic diversity. It's like when you always reproduce within the same more or less genetic thing, you lose, you know, you lose like quality. You have to mix with different species that come from far away, have different genetic that will make the sapling stronger.
Basically, the plants are being forced to inbreed for having no other species around them to bring new genetics into the breeding cycles that helps to open up the potential of that plant.
Yeah, that is called the genetic islands. And that is much a lot of things that is much happening in the center of Spain, because I mean the forests that we have are so isolated from one each other, and there's no the landscape is fragmented. There's not a way to for animals to move the seeds or whatever from one to the other.
Yeah.
And we have to realize this is important, because what we have, we not only have to keep, we have to enhance and improve, and we need those corridors.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to maybe go into your particular approach to when you go into a project, and it's very rare that we don't see highly degraded ecosystems. Where do you start? Where do you start the investigation process, and how do you start to uncover the potential of a place when it's already so severely damaged?
Where do I stay? I always do as deep as I can site assessments, always. and not only, you know, the weather conditions, the sun, the wind, not only that, I always ask for analysis of the soil, biological, physical, chemical, if and it's even variable. So Kalikata's deep soil test. I always try to gather as much information of the water, the watershed, or the little watershed where this place belongs, and try to, if I'm lucky, to see how when it rains, how the water moves through the soil. This is super important to see that, and to try to gather as much information from the owners or the people are surrounding of the history of the place or the surrounding places. And it's always important for me to try to see the actual vegetal communities that live within that place or near, to see where I want to go. I always try to think, what will this look like if we haven't done anything through history? Well, how do I get closer to that, but also a balancing with some kind of profit from the project if they are an agricultural or forested project? That's really more or less what I do. Yeah, I was, as you know, as I do that, I study the potential vegetation and all of that. And
yeah, and so first of all, your knowledge base here, I think you're understating. From all that you've learned from the different projects that you've worked on, my conversations with you are really stunning, and I want to kind of tap into that here. So when you get the results back from reading a landscape, from the soil test that you do, how do you extrapolate that information into what the vegetal potential of a place could be?
Well, there is, many years ago, there was a botanist in Spain that he created like a methodology to do this. So you gather all this information, and then you just start. There's a full methodology to do it that I learned in college as a forest engineer. So I just do it. I just follow that methodology and get there. And then, I mean, nature is not zeros and ones. It changes. So from that methodology, you have to adapt to where you are. So this methodology gives me this place. Should grow this type of plant community, yes. But then I have a river by, and then I have a big mountain that is shading it. And then I have to take into account where we are and start moving within the similar vegetal communities that should be there. It's like more of a observation and thinking, and it's more of that.
Yeah.
How I do it.
Well, let's give a real example here. So let's use my farm as a potential site that we're looking at, because I'm in the early stages and starting to gather the baseline data and information about how I'm currently finding it, because I haven't started to put in any features. I haven't started to farm anything. I haven't really brought in animals at all yet. I had chickens last year, but that's not, they stayed around my house. It was mostly just for fun. So I have a lot of different little microclimates where I live. I have very challenging soil circumstances, mostly being granite sand. We've talked about this before. You know a bit about the biome that I'm working in from the information that I've sent you before. Maybe talk me through some of the steps that you would recommend to gather the necessary information before starting to make planting recommendations or implementation recommendations. Tell me what I need to look into and the questions I need to answer before we get to that stage.
Well, for me, as I already said, it's basic. I mean, this is a must. You have to do a soil analysis, the three kinds, the physical, chemical, the biological, and the Kalikata. The Kalikata.
Yeah.
That's
a
must.
We're talking about a deeper also profile one, and then when you're referring to it.
Yeah, deeper, right? Profile. So you can see the edaphic forests, and you can see where the mother rock is at the depth, if you can find it. Or sometimes you find it's basic. Not the rock you find. I do not know the name in English. It's in where I live, it's called Toba, that it's a layer of really clay, compacted clay soil. It's not compacted because of the tractors. It's just that it lives there. It's maybe 3 meters down. Sometimes you find that at 2 meters or at 50 centimeters. You don't know, but sometimes you find that. And it's not an uncommon thing to find. And you have to do that hole in order to see a little. And you're not going to have all the information, but it will give you a little bit. And I would recommend not to do one, but a few of them in different places.
Yeah, various around different areas, of course. Yeah.
Exactly, because the soil underneath, the layers, they move like they are like, you know, sinuous. They're like this, and you have to do. So that is a must you have to do, in my opinion. Of course, gathering the climate information, of course, that's another must, even though we have to realize that we are in a moment of climate change, and the climate information is probably from the last 30 years. That doesn't really mean that it's going to be that way in the next 5 years. But it gives you an orientation. What I usually do is like, if you are in a place that it has 500 millimeters of water per year, I always estimate, in my designs, I always take out the 20% because of the climate change.
Yeah.
To put me in the worst conditions, you know? So I always do that because we do not know where the climate change is going to take us, but probably we will have either less water through rain or either more sand that will evaporate more water. So at the end, the balance of water will be 20% less. That's right. What I do usually.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people don't account for the evaporation rates too, because even if you get an above average rainfall year, if it all falls in a very short period of time and most of the rest of the year is of higher temperature and more solar radiation, your evaporation rates are going to offset a huge amount of that rainfall.
Exactly. Yes. And that is something that has to be taken into account. And also, and another thing for that, for me, as I told you before, it's important, is a study of the potential vegetation to see where we should be, so to try to head towards there. And again, here we have climate change. Of course, climate change will change the condition and will change the vegetal communities that lives in a place, and then will move. That will happen. But we cannot predict the future. So we know what vegetable communities used to be there and in the nearby surroundings. And we try to, at least I try to adapt to that, maybe to a vegetable community that is a little bit drier than the one that was like 50 or 100 years ago. But I try to adapt to that. And within that, that you are seeing the soil, the biology, of course, the water, you have an idea of what. What are you talking about?
Yeah, mine is really dynamic. The study of the plant communities here is what I've been spending a lot of time on so far. And it's nice that there's a lot of digital tools that can make it easier for people who are not already familiar with the flora of their area. So for example, I've been using apps like PlantNet and iNaturalist to build a personal database of what I observe on my place. And not only have I been expanding my own knowledge of plant identification for this area, but I've also been finding where there are concentrations of certain species where I don't see them as a larger pattern in other areas. And because we're in such a steep landscape and there's a river that runs right through the property, trying to find the difference between the ones that thrive in the lower areas near the river and what we would call riparian species, as well as the ones that are further up the mountain and really live in, well, decomposed granite, which is really the parent material from everything that I have around here, and the soils that are commonly referred to as saulo in this area, which are very sandy, generally poor in nutrients, on the acidic side. You know, this is all the stuff that we've talked about in the past. But also realizing that even though this is not at all what most people would consider a fertile agricultural area, there's really healthy plant communities all over. Now, you know, we're in a historic drought, so a lot of them are quite stressed. But even in these challenging conditions, there is so much potential for life. And I think that's really important for people to understand, even if the results that they get from doing this analysis show that there are missing nutrients, there are mineral deficiencies, there are water handling problems, there are invasive species or other things that, you know, represent challenges. It doesn't necessarily represent an upper limit on what is possible when we start to do very select and intentional interventions that can reset the trajectory for the land that you're managing.
Yes, actually. And also the actual plant communities can tell you a lot about what's going on and what's going on in the soil from a nutrition point of view and a water point of view. So they have to be, of course, take into account. And they will give you lots of information of what can you do or what should you not do. So yeah, that's really important. And I agree with you. Like sometimes some people say, no, because in Spain, we don't have enough water. Yeah, we don't have a lot of water, rainfall, I mean. But we do have rainfall and we can do many things. We just have to be conscious and be care and be respectful of the plants that we have and try, like for example, like the grasses from a golf course, they live naturally in Ireland or in Brittany because they have a lot of water. If we try to bring them here, we have a problem. But we have many, many plants and communities that thrive with our water and our conditions that we just have to work with them, not try to import things that live in other climates. Mm-hmm. So, and there's there are so many things we can do with our own conditions. And
yeah. I think that's a really important message, not only for those of us who live here in this part of Western Europe, but for anybody who is jealous of the rainfall of another area or even what they might have had 50 or 100 years ago and feel like there is a bleak future ahead of them. It's true that, you know, if you start to compare yourself to neighbors or to people that you see on social media who are doing all sorts of incredible things and having their gardens grow without having to bring in irrigation or having to do much for fertilization, that is an unrealistic thing to compare your area to. And it also limits the potential if you're not taking advantage of what does really well with native plant communities and, you know, start running experiments and see what can thrive in your area. Even in some of the most challenging regions that I've seen around the world, they are doing amazing things by leveraging the potential of the biology that is native to their area and that is on the edges of experimentation with the way that the climate is headed. But, you know, we do have to start to work with natural processes instead of fight them or bring in surrogates as a way to try and overcome the circumstances that we find.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. And although we are in the middle of a climate change situation, the genetics for the plants that live in a certain area are adapted to that soil, not only the weather, it's that soil that lack or not of nutrients, that acidity, whatever the situation of that specific area. And that is really a huge thing to take into account, into the equation.
Yeah, it's true. So we've come a long way on this discussion already. We've gone through almost prehistory of the Iberian Peninsula, changes of land management times over hundreds, if not thousands of years, all the way to current challenges and potential here. With this large trajectory of our conversation, let's try and leave our listeners with a final message of hope for what they can do in their spaces. What would you tell someone listening who is seeing or dealing with the challenges that we're all facing in this part of the world and what they could potentially do and where they should start?
I think that we all have to be aware that we are in a situation of transition with the climate change and we have to take actions because of that, which means in many cases to really look at what you have, what's going on, what is missing, or like water, for example, usually is missing, and what actions can you do to change that? That little actions, in my opinion, little actions with very low or non-technology work much better in a larger scale than technology-based actions. And plus they're cheaper. And they are easier usually to install. So it's in everybody's hand to start doing that. And if you're in a larger scale you can always hire designers like United Designers or me or myself. That is what we do. We find those solutions and we try to make a framework for them to create a plan for their fincas or whatever, so they can start implementing things and to work with nature towards this new situation where we are. And that is, but you can do it in a bigger scale or in a larger scale, even in urban circumstances, you can do it everywhere. That's what I think it's
I absolutely love that message. And I think I would add that for people who are considering getting a designer or a consultant for their project, the upfront cost is often made back very quickly by not making a bunch of mistakes that are perfectly avoidable for not having the knowledge or the guidance to get started.
Yes.
You know, so many people who have started to plant things, watch their plants die, start to get discouraged, and, you know, either give up or take a different approach and try and use technological or chemical means to shortcut the progress that they wanted to make, when so many of those issues could easily be overcome by partnering with someone with experience and knowledge that can just help to avoid that burnout, those early mistakes. You can start getting those early wins and begin on a trajectory that ends up paying for itself really quickly, especially if you're new to an area and don't know that much about the ecology, the unique challenges, or the water situation where you're from. So, you know, definitely consider partnering with an expert, at least in the beginning, to get you started. And then, you know, do the types of experiments and implementations that you can manage with your budget, with your timeline, something that fits your life, and build on those successes.
Yeah, and also be patient and work with nature, you know, not try to have it all in 1 year, because that is not going to happen.
It's
be patient and be aware that nature has its time and its things, its way to doing things, and you have to respect that and be certain that it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. So, Sarah, where can our listeners find more about your own company, and how can they get in touch with you through United Designers as well?
Well, I have my webpage is ecoloniza.es. Over there, you will find my email, my phone number, if you want to contact me. And of course, you always have United Designers, uniteddesigners.org. And you will find me and an excellent team of people all over the world working on these designs. And if we can help you there, just call us. There, over there is the email and the telephone.
Perfect. Well, I'll be sure to put all those links in the show notes for this episode. And I want to thank you personally for all of the help and the advice that you've given me as I orient myself to a new part of the world and start to understand the ecology of where I live based on the resources and the knowledge that you have. I know I'm going to continue to reach out to you for support on this journey. And I really hope that we get an opportunity to work on projects more together in the future.
Yeah, well, of course, I will hope so too, Oliver. And thank you for this chat we have. And thank you for everything.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. All right, we'll be in touch soon. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Bye.
Thanks once again to Sarah. I've put all of the links to her company and that of United Designers in the links in the show notes for the episode at regenerativeskills.com.
Now, before we wrap this up, just remember that these episodes are only the beginning of the learning resources, design and coaching services, in-person courses, and interactive community that are available through Regenerative Skills. The Discord server is our free community where you can connect with other like-minded listeners, exchange ideas, stories, tips, and resources, as well as interact with me directly and quite a few former guests from this show. Our Instagram account, @regen_skills, is the best place to see the projects that me and the team are working on, both for clients and collaborators, as well as on our own properties. I'll also be announcing the certification courses, workshops, and gatherings that we've got coming up later this year. If you're interested in getting dedicated support for your own project, you can now schedule a free planning session with one of our team members through the request form on our website. You can also find all the links, show notes, and past resources there at regenerativeskills.com. We truly believe that no matter your experience, your knowledge, abilities, resources, or background, you can be a powerful force for regeneration on this planet, and we're here to help you find your path. So as always, remember to keep taking those little steps every day towards a regenerative future, and I'll be right by your side along the way.